Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, September 28th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Residents Voice Concerns on Cemetery. Many complained about irrigation, landscaping at Fairview Cemetery. By Caitlin Randall. During Monday's Commissioner's Court meeting, Midland County residents expressed concern about the condition of Fairview Cemetery and asked commissioners to dedicate funding toward making repairs. Pat McDaniel, director of the Haley Memorial Library and History Center, led the group of about 10 community members who spoke at Monday's meeting. A lot of us here today have felt for a long time that the county needs to allocate more assets out to an asset they have. Fairview is not just a liability. Fairview is an asset, McDaniel told the court. It's an asset in regard to quality of life. It's an asset regarding historical heritage. It's an asset that we believe needs to be protected and enhanced and maintained properly. Many residents complained about the irrigation system at the cemetery and said the grass and landscaping has not been taken care of. They asked that the court begin improvements by installing an in-ground sprinkler system. This cemetery has been forgotten, said June Cowden. Ignored. It's a disgrace. It's shameful and hurtful to go out there and see the graves of your loved ones covered in weeds. Cowden and her daughter Linda were some of the several members of longtime Midland families who spoke at the meeting. Elaine Magruder and John Scarborough also addressed the court on Monday. The commissioner's court seemed to be in consensus about allotting funds toward upgrading Fairview's irrigation system and setting up the infrastructure to connect sprinklers to city water. Water at the cemetery is currently coming from well water, the court said. I'm a fifth generation from Midland County, and I want to apologize to all of you guys that have come in here and to ask us to do something about the cemetery that your families are buried in, County Judge Terry Johnson told those in attendance. I really think it should not have gotten to that point. If we're going to be in the cemetery business, we need to get in it with both feet. Commissioners said they would be scheduling a special meeting before October 1st so they could allot funds toward improving the cemetery before the start of the 2022 fiscal year. This article is entitled I-20 Wildlife Preserve to Present New Film. Trio of Events to Celebrate Premiere of the Documentary by J.C. Lewis. Save the date for the release of I-20 Wildlife Preserve's new documentary on a fun night out. There will be three events happening November 8th in downtown Midland to celebrate the premiere of Playas, Land of the Little Lakes, a documentary according to the website. The film was made in partnership with Permian Basin PBS and the I-20 Wildlife Preserve and Jenna Welch Nature Study Center. Attendees can experience three different events happening at the same time. The red carpet event will be at Basin PBS from 6 to 9 p.m. Then the gala will be happening at the Bush Convention Center from 6 to 11 p.m. Attendees will have dinner and can dance to the music of Comanche Moon Band. Tickets for the gala are $250. The evening's benefits will go to programs of the I-20 Wildlife Preserve and Jenna Welch Nature Study Center. The documentary will also be playing on the big screen in Centennial Park. Party in the Park will be from 6 to 9 p.m. with food trucks and entertainment for all ages before the showing of Playas, Land of the Little Lakes. This event is free, but registration is requested. To buy tickets or register for the Party in the Park, visit nightoftheplaya.com. This article is entitled, Guzman Wants AG's Race to Be About Qualifications. She says others don't have her experience, record of integrity. By Stuart Doreen. Republican Eva Guzman isn't running for Attorney General as a Hispanic. She's running as a conservative. She's running as the most qualified of any candidate. She is running to take down the sitting Attorney General, who she believes will be a liability for the party in 2022. And after Guzman appeared at the Republican National Hispanic Assembly luncheon at the Bush Convention Center, she said quite confidently that Republicans have become the party of Hispanics, because Hispanics are conservative. The values that unite us are values that transcend a lot of things, Guzman said after the event. There's more that unites us than divides us. Our respect for life, we will fight for the unborn, our desire to be given an opportunity, not a handout, but a hand up. So all of these things that unite us are what's going to allow the Republican Party to continue to speak to these communities. And you've seen it happen in South Texas and all over the state. Latinos are working, waking up to the fact that the Republican Party represents them, their values, and the best chance at a future in this country. Guzman is in the early stages of a potential competitive primary against current Attorney General Ken Paxton, Land Commissioner George P. Bush, and State Representative Matt Krause of Fort Worth. Guzman brings more than a decade of experience on the Texas Supreme Court to the race. She was appointed to the court in 2009 by then-Governor Rick Perry. She won election to that seat two times, including re-election in 2016. Guzman said after the event that this is not the same Republican Party of even 20 years ago. She talked about conservatism being the primary trait Republican Party voters look at. She mentioned that in the same breath as her becoming the highest vote-getter in the history of the state of Texas, more votes than anyone who would ever run for office in this state, either as a Republican or Democrat, and that was in the Republican primary. What that tells me is that our wonderful Republican voters, our beautiful communities around this state, are looking at candidates for their qualifications and for their commitment to uphold the Constitution, not for their last name, Guzman said. And qualifications are where Guzman thinks she separates herself from the pack. She says the other Republican primary candidates don't have her qualifications, her experience, her record of integrity, or her sound judgment. While Monday's presentation in front of the RNHA allowed Midlanders to get to know the candidate, Guzman sought to plant the seeds for why she is the superior candidate. She was critical of one, Bush, for not having his law license for over a decade, and the other, Paxton, for his legal woes. Would you hire someone who's indicted and facing a serious FBI investigation? Guzman said, although not mentioning his name. No, you would hire someone who is credible, who brings over 22 years of experience handling constitutional questions, and who will uphold the rule of law every single day. Guzman said the experience inside the courtroom will help her put together the best arguments of those Republicans running for Attorney General. She said she worries about federal government overreach that could impact the business, safety, and religious opportunities of everyday Texans. She said the Attorney General's office needs to be a first-class operation with its thousands of employees, hundreds of attorneys, 33,000 cases, and $2 billion budget. We are freedom-loving, kind-hearted Americans, Guzman said. We ask that you respect rule of law, honor our values, and respect the Constitution. It is not a living document. It says what it says, and you can't change it. This article is entitled GOP Tries to Protect Seats Under New Maps by Paul J. Weber and Ocasio-Coronado, Associated Press. Austin. Facing up to Texas's booming suburbs turning bluer, Republicans on Monday proposed new U.S. House maps that would fortify their slipping grip and shrink the number of seats where the majority of voters are Hispanic, even as they fuel the state's blistering growth. Texas was a big winner in the 2020 census. Its surging population, driven by nearly 2 million new Hispanic residents, made it the only state awarded two additional congressional seats. Texas will now have 38 House members and 40 electoral votes. But Democrats and minority rights groups accused GOP mapmakers of tossing aside those rapidly shifting demographic trends that are threatening decades of Republican dominance. Persons of color accounted for more than 9 of every 10 new Texas residents over the last decade. But the proposal reduces the number of Hispanic majority districts from 8 to 7. There would also be no districts with a majority of black residents under the proposed maps, which are likely to undergo revisions. But outnumbered Democrats in the Texas Capitol have no power to force drastic changes. It is not fair, it is not right, it is not Texan or American to do that, said Domingo Garcia, president of the League of United Latin American Citizens, referring to how the maps divide up Hispanic voters. On the whole, Republicans showed an overarching desire under the proposed maps to protect their nearly 24 incumbent House members rather than peel away seats from Democrats. One notable exception is along the Texas-Mexico border, where Republicans, encouraged by former President Donald Trump's strong showing there in 2020, are taking aim at a longtime Democratic stronghold currently held by Representative Vicente Gonzalez. In every decade since the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, courts or the Department of Justice have ruled that Texas's redistricting plans violated federal laws, partly by scattering Democratic-leaning Latino voters among multiple districts dominated by non-Latino white residents who lean Republican. It looks like they packed more Democratic voters into fewer districts and sort of spread the Republican voters across more districts, said Adam Podowitz-Thomas, senior legal strategist at the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, a nonpartisan research organization. He said multiple districts seem to have been drawn to include a safe 60-70% majority Republican vote share that would preserve GOP control. But a new congressional district in the state's liberal capital was a Democratic vote sink, said Podowitz-Thomas, one that would insulate surrounding Republican House members by taking some of their left-leaning voters. Another proposed new district in Houston is drawn to elect a Republican, meaning both parties would split Texas's new seats. Republicans currently have 23 House seats in Texas, while Democrats have 13. Latino advocates and office holders believe the members demanded at least one new Latino-majority congressional seat in Texas around the Dallas area, but none was included in the Republicans' first pass. Booming suburban districts in Texas, which include 4 of the 10 fastest-growing and rapidly diversifying cities in the U.S., would be fortified with more voters pulled from surrounding rural areas. This article is entitled, "Total Sees Demand Peaking Before 2030," by François de Beaupuis, Bloomberg. French energy giant Total Energies SE expects global oil demand to peak before the end of this decade as more nations crack down on fossil fuels and promote cleaner power in transport and industry to mitigate global warming. Total's 2021 energy outlook, which takes into account new net zero pledges made by countries, including the US and China, assumes crude demand will plateau before 2030 and then decline, the company said Monday in a statement. Although Total sees the pace of emissions reductions accelerating by 2050, governments and businesses still need to do more to achieve the Paris Agreement's goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius compared with pre-industrial levels. There is a key trend, which is electrification, mainly in renewables, Total Energy's chief executive officer Patrick Pouin said Monday on a conference call. The energy world is moving quickly. Total's momentum scenario, which is based on environmental targets and policies announced worldwide, points to a 2.2 to 2.4 degree increase in global temperatures by the end of the century. The rupture scenario, which would limit the increase to 1.7 degrees, assumes a strong shift in public policies worldwide and large-scale progress in clean energy technologies. Powering renewables. This year's report considerably raises the company's forecast for global solar and wind investments by the middle of the century to electrify transport as governments increasingly ban the sale of internal combustion vehicles. The cost of the energy transition could be a challenge, even in rich nations and regions such as the European Union. And governments will have to mitigate these costs, especially for low-income earners, if they want to succeed, Puan said. European authorities must also reduce red tape and work to increase public acceptance of renewables if they want to meet their targets for wind and solar power developments, he added. Meanwhile, natural gas is seen keeping its role as a transition fuel, especially as carbon dioxide and methane emissions are increasingly reined in. Europe's gas crunch is partly due to a lack of investment and supply chain constraints since the start of the pandemic, Puan said. It's also caused by a 35% increase in this year's liquefied natural gas demand from China versus 2019, as Beijing seeks to curb the use of polluting coal, he said. We need to monitor smoothly the transition by investing more and more in renewable and decarbonized energies, Puan said. But at the same time, we need to maintain a certain level of investment in the energies that we are using today. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled Brent Rises to Highest Since 2018 on Global Energy Crunch, by Sheila Tobin. Brent closed at the highest in nearly 3 years amid signs the crude market is rapidly tightening from a global energy crunch. The global benchmark crude surged 1.8% on Monday, but met some resistance as it neared the key psychological $80 a barrel level. Its U.S. counterpart rose 2% to close above $75 a barrel for the first time since July. Both benchmarks are set to continue climbing as supply struggles to catch up with fast-rising demand, according to Trafigura Group's co-head of oil trading, Ben Luckock. His remarks came as Goldman Sachs Group Inc. said Brent could hit $90 by year-end, as the market is in a bigger deficit than many realize. Brent failed to break $80 because some speculators were taking profits, said Bob Yager, director of the Futures Division at Mizuho Securities. We should look for the market to reload and give the $80 level another shot in the coming days. Crude is rallying on signs that inventories globally are falling sharply, with demand heating up ahead of winter, and OPEC Plus only slowly adding barrels back to the market. As traders eye the prospect of large market deficits, Trafigura said longer-dated oil prices remain cheap at around $70 a barrel. So-called time spreads, which gauge market strength, have rallied sharply in recent weeks in another sign that traders are positive about the outlook. Observable inventory draws are the largest on record, Goldman Sachs analysts, including Damien Kourvalin, wrote in a note to clients. This deficit will not be reversed in coming months, in our view, as its scale will overwhelm both the willingness and ability of OPEC Plus to ramp up. WTI's front-month contract traded at the biggest premium to its second month in nearly 2 months. Meanwhile, OPEC Plus is scheduled to meet on October 4th to review its output policy. Internal documents from the group have already highlighted the risk of the natural gas crisis ramping up demand. World oil consumption could be boosted by an additional 370,000 barrels a day, roughly 6% of expected growth, if gas prices stay high enough for an extended period, according to the group. U.S. natural gas futures rose for a third straight session on Monday as inventory levels stayed low ahead of the heating season. This article is entitled, Dems Prep Carbon Tax Option to Pay for Spending Bill, by Laura Davison, Ari Natter, and Jennifer A. DeLuey, Bloomberg. Senate Democrats are developing a carbon tax proposal that could potentially be used to offset some of the costs of a sweeping social spending bill, as well as direct cash payments to households, according to a key lawmaker. It's projected that making polluters pay, when combined with clean energy tax credits, would lower the cost of clean electricity for Americans, Senate Finance Chairman Ron Wyden said in a statement to Bloomberg News Friday. I've worked on this for years and have continued to develop the proposal as part of my menu of options for the caucus. A substantial portion of the revenue generated from a carbon tax would be dispersed to Americans in the form of cash payments, Wyden said. That could help increase public support for the tax, but would also mean less money to offset the cost of the up to $3.5 trillion bill, so-called reconciliation bill. That bill, incorporating the bulk of President Joe Biden's long-term economic agenda, includes overhauling climate investment and directing money into health and education programs. Negotiations are ongoing on Capitol Hill. The New York Times earlier reported Wyden's plans to pursue a carbon tax. Industry stance. Momentum for such a levy is growing as a way to address climate change. And economists have long favored a carbon tax as a straightforward approach to putting a price on the greenhouse gas emissions. Advocates say it would encourage companies and consumers to pollute less. The American Petroleum Institute, the oil industry trade group that counts ExxonMobil Corporation among its members, and the Chamber of Commerce have both endorsed a price on carbon, which could take the form of a levy. But industry supporters generally want the carbon tax imposed as a substitute for existing regulations on greenhouse gases, a trade-off that is unlikely to be part of the plan Democrats are assembling. Though several Senate supporters have been eyeing the reconciliation bill as a potential pathway for the tax measure for more than a year, it's gained momentum over the last several weeks, according to a person familiar with negotiations on the issue. The tax is appealing because of its role as a potential revenue raiser, but lawmakers are also working to ensure that a significant chunk of the proceeds goes back to middle and low-income families. A carbon tax could draw more support as a way to replace other revenue raisers, assuage moderates' concerns about the size of the package, and give the Biden administration tangible proof of robust U.S. plans to slash greenhouse emissions before a critical UN summit in 5 weeks. Still, a tax that could increase the costs of driving, flying, and consumer goods is likely to face stiff political resistance from some quarters. And Republicans previously have voted against the concept of placing a tax on carbon dioxide. Some moderate Republicans, including Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Mitt Romney of Utah, have signaled they are receptive to the idea. GOP opposition wouldn't be able to nix the proposal because Democrats aim to pass the tax and spending bill on a party-line vote. Still, Democrats have tight majorities in both chambers, meaning that they need nearly every member in the House and all 50 caucus members in the Senate to support the legislation. Coal country. Senator Joe Manchin, a moderate Democrat who represents coal-reliant West Virginia, would be a key consideration in the drafting of a carbon tax. Manchin has been non-committal on the issue, but voted with members of his party on a messaging amendment earlier this year in support of such a tax. Supporters argue that a domestic carbon tax would have to be paired with a levy on imports, known as a carbon border adjustment tax, to protect U.S. workers in energy-intensive industries and to ensure that companies don't shift manufacturing out of the U.S. to nations with lax environmental regimes. National Climate Advisor Gina McCarthy, Bloomberg in July, that while it's not off the table, there are strategies other than a carbon border adjustment tax that may be more beneficial. Even so, U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, John Kerry, on Wednesday, dangled the prospect of a tariff on carbon-intensive imports if other nations don't limit their emissions and reliance on coal-fired power to fuel cheap manufacturing. This is the obituary column. Tuesday, September 28th. Betty Jean Simmons. Betty Jean Simmons, 90, passed away on September 25th at Faith Presbyterian Hospice in Dallas. She was born on December 30th, 1930, to O.L. Happ and Essie Emily Forrest Stultz. Betty was married to Orrin Simmons, and they had one son, Dale Simmons. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, and one of her sisters, Irene Stultz Rotan. Those left to cherish Betty's memories are her son, Dale Simmons of Midland, her sister, Freddie Stultz Locks, and her husband, Norman of Irving, and numerous nieces and nephews. Graveside services will be at Fairview Cemetery in Midland. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations be made to the Faith Presbyterian Hospice in Dallas. 12477 Merritt Drive, Dallas. 75251. Beverly Jo Bruner. Beverly Jo Bruner of Midland went to his heavenly home on September 24th. Joe was a beloved husband, father, and granddad. He was born on January 4, 1927, to Patty and W.L. Bruner in Rural Shade, Texas. Joe is survived by his wife, Shirley Bruner of Midland, brother and sister-in-law, Harold and Linda Bruner of Lubbock, son, Bobby Bruner, and wife, Sharon Phelps of San Angelo, son and daughter-in-law, Kyle and Kim Bruner of Kingsland, five grandchildren, and six great-grandchildren. He is preceded in death by his oldest son, David Bruner, and brothers Sam Bruner and Kenneth Bruner. A private graveside service was held on Monday, September 27th at 11 a.m. at Rest Haven Cemetery. In lieu of flowers and in remembrance of Joe's life, the family asks that any charitable donations be made to the WoundedWarriorProject.org or a tribute gift to the Alzheimer's Association. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Mike L. Honey Hernandez, Jr. Mike L. Honey Hernandez, Jr., 64, of Midland, was received into heaven on September 24th. Mike was born in Midland on November 16, 1956, to Miguel Sr. and Lila Hernandez. Mike was preceded in death by his parents, sister Elisa Garibay, brother John Hernandez, and godson Joshua Hernandez. He is survived by his wife Rita, who was the love of his life. He was a devoted father to Christina Vasquez and her husband Raymond, Joaquina Paredes and her husband Isaac, Flora Hernandez. He was Grandpa Honey to his five grandchildren. Mike was a faithful brother to Delia Jimenez, Arturo Salazar, and wife Elia, Vicente Hernandez and wife Chela, Flora Munoz and husband Thomas, Linda Sotelo and husband Edward, Adolfo Hernandez and wife Donna, and Viola Hernandez. Viewing will be Tuesday, September 28th from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. and Wednesday, September 29th from 2 to 8 p.m. A rosary will be held at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, September 29th at Willowbrook Funeral Home. A funeral mass will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday, September 30th at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine. Services are entrusted to Willowbrook Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Midland. To place online condolences, visit www.willowbrk.com. Peggy Mae Duncan Ford. Peggy Mae Duncan Ford was promoted into Christ's glory on Friday, September 24th. Peggy was born October 10, 1927, in Ardmore, Oklahoma. Peggy joins her husband, William T. Ford, and her son, William T. Ford III, in Christ's presence and will be waiting in glory for those who have survived her. Her three children, Patricia Ford Lanning, her husband Lane, William Michael Ford, his wife Cynthia, James Kyle Ford, his wife Irina, and her nine grandchildren. Memorial service will be Wednesday, September 29th at 2 p.m. at Christ Church Anglican, and reception to follow at the church. Private family burial will be held at Rest Haven Cemetery. Flowers can be sent to Nallie Picklin Welch Funeral Home or donations made to Christ Church Anglican or www.give.cru.org. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Death Notices. Cesar Chavez. Cesar Chavez, 28, of Midland, passed away on Wednesday, September 22nd. Rosary will be held on Thursday, September 30th at 7 p.m. at the branch at NPW. Funeral Mass will be held Friday, October 1st at 2 p.m. at St. Stephen's Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. Survivors include wife Madison Chavez and parents Mariella and Cesar Chavez. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Henry Patrick Ryan. Henry Patrick Ryan, 72, of Odessa, passed away on September 23rd at his home. Henry was born on December 16, 1948, to Harry and Lenora Faye Edgar Ryan in Chicago. Henry proudly served his country in the United States Air Force. He is survived by his spouse, Tammy Lee Ryan, six children, Tia Ryan, Christy Stevenson, Tarak, Julie Ryan, Sarah Ryan, Benjamin Ryan, and Rachel Ryan, nine grandchildren and one brother. Visitation will be held on Tuesday, September 28th from 5 to 8 p.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home in Midland. Funeral services will be on Wednesday, September 29th at 6 p.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home Cemetery. Arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory. Iona Grau. Iona Grau, 97, of Midland, passed away Thursday, September 23rd. The family will hold services Saturday, October 9th at 2 p.m. at Grace Lutheran Church. Survivors include daughter Neta Gore. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Jose Rafael Hernandez. Jose Rafael Hernandez, 28, of Midland, passed away on September 23rd at Midland Memorial Hospital. Jose was born on October 8, 1972, to Jose and Nadine Balderas Hernandez in San Bernardino, California. He is survived by one daughter, Inez Elizabeth Hernandez, four grandchildren, his parents, Jose and Nadine Balderas Hernandez, and two brothers. There are no services planned at this time. Michael Granado. Michael Granado, 48, of Midland, passed away on Monday, September 20th. Rosary will be Monday, September 27th at 7 p.m. at Heavenly Gate Funeral Home. Funeral Mass is set for Tuesday, September 28th at 10 a.m. at St. Stephen's Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Tammy Adair Dennis. Tammy Adair Dennis, 55, of Midland, passed away on September 24th. The family will receive friends on Thursday, September 30th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Nallie Picklin Welch Funeral Home. Graveside services will be held on Friday, October 1st at 11 a.m. at Rest Haven Cemetery. Survivors include husband Jeff Dennis, son Jeffrey Dennis, and daughter Molly Dennis. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Wes Toon. Wes Toon, 62, of Midland, passed away on Saturday, September 25th. Graveside services will be held on Thursday, September 30th at 11 a.m. at Rest Haven Memorial Park Cemetery. He is survived by his wife, Stelice Toon, children Lauren Shoemaker and Kaylin Toon. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Leona Marshall. Leona Marshall, 94, of Midland, passed away on September 26th. There are no services scheduled. She is survived by her daughter, Lynette Amador, and son, David McNeese. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com.
Hi, I'm Kim, and I am reading the Odessa American. Today is September 28th, 2021. Judge questions hospital's funding needs. Ector County Judge Debbie Hayes on Monday questioned whether MCH and ORMC need requested county funding to help the hospitals meet escalating costs due to COVID-19. Both hospitals in August submitted funding requests after the county received $16 million in federal American Rescue Plan Act dollars. "I'm not saying that I'm for or against giving funds to the hospitals," Hayes said. "The hospitals have surely done much good and have been heroes during the community struggle with COVID-19. But at some point, through the normal process, the question has been asked, how much money do you need? County commissioners today will consider a proposal to solicit bids from consulting firms vying to serve as an administrator of the county's ARPA funds. The hired company would be responsible for vetting applications and recommending applicants for commissioners to choose from," Hayes said. "The selected company would also conduct financial audits to make sure the money is used correctly." MCH has requested $7 million from the county, ORMC $2.6 million. Hayes noted that both hospitals have already received millions of dollars in federal funding, and the city council recently allotted $3 million in ARPA funds to MCH and another $1 million to OMRC. "They received a lot of money last year, and I believe they'll be getting more money in September," Hayes said. Several Odessa City Council members in recent weeks have publicly criticized county commissioners for taking so long to consider funding requests for MCH and ORMC. During a recent council meeting, MCH President and CEO Russell Tippin explained that the hospitals had not yet received a response by county commissioners. "So they put their decision on hold. Is COVID on hold for you?" an incensed City Councilman Steve Thompson responded. "The city keeps stepping up and doing what they should be doing. Why can't the county? It's supposed to be called the County Health Department, not the City Health Department." Hayes explained on Monday that the county is taking their time to make sure the ARPA funds are allotted fairly and given to organizations that truly need money. "It wouldn't be fair for the same size companies or organizations to keep getting all the money," Hayes said. "You don't want entities that have other supplies of money to keep getting all the money," Hayes said. The county commission will also conduct a public hearing on the county's proposal budget for fiscal year 2021-22. Commissioners are likely to adopt the proposed budget during their meeting. The proposed general fund operating budget is $66,615,862, with about $18.4 million in reserves. County commissioners are also expected to vote to maintain the current property tax of 0.365 for fiscal year 2021-22. The decision could increase or decrease overall property tax revenues based on whether property and mineral rates are higher or lower, Hayes had previously said. Many homeowners, however, have reported a higher appraisal this year. COVID numbers down slightly. Hospitalizations have gone down, but COVID continues to tax Odessa's hospitals and staff, both in terms of exhausting staff and finances. During Monday's COVID Zoom call with local health officials, the topic of finances was at the forefront, as Ector County commissioners are scheduled to discuss today how to administer the county's portion of the American Rescue Plan Act funding. Both Medical Center Hospital and Odessa Regional Center requested funding from Ector County in August. MCH CEO Russell Tippin asked the county for $7 million and detailed that the county could get that $7 million and the $2.5 million requested by ORMC back through a FEMA program. Both MCH and ORMC were awarded a portion of the City of Odessa's ARPA funding recently. Both Tippin and ORMC CEO Stacy Brown have praised the city officials for their quick decision on the funding. The county response has not been quick. On Monday, County Judge Debbie Hayes said the county may hire an outside agency to help administer the county rescue funds. She praised the work of the local hospitals and said they were heroes, but also said the ARPA funding should not just go to the large institutions. She said both hospitals have received millions of dollars in federal funding and also millions from the city. You don't want entities that have other supplies of money to keep getting all the money, Hayes said. Tippin said he went before the commissioners in the summer and detailed how the county could help the hospitals and still get that money back from FEMA. I know the court has not reached out since then, Tippin said. The judge has not reached out. We just keep pressing forward. Brown added that the ARPA funding from the city comes with a contract that requires both hospitals to see that the city has the paperwork needed to recover the funding they earmarked for the hospital. It is absolute documentation of that, Brown said. Tippin said the city has set the standard for how to communicate with other entities. It's frustrating to have to rehash all this when there is no communication from the other side. The one thing that has remained consistent is that patients need us, not just Odessa, but all the counties of West Texas. These are tax dollars. We are just trying to pump that into the taxpayer laying in the hospital beds. Tippin addressed the question of how much funding do the hospitals need. This pandemic has been focused around one thing, he said, how important the quality and availability of health care is. No other industry has faced what the health industry has faced. The question of how much money we need is more than the county could ever have. What we have asked the county is to meet an immediate need, which is staffing and equipment. The real dollars go back into the system for patient-facing care. He said no one knows how important nurses, housekeepers, doctors, and other workers are until you are the patient lying in bed wondering where health care is. Medical Center is doing the best we can. Anything any group can do for the hospital is a blessing. MCH had 69 COVID patients on Monday, with 28 in critical care and 20 on ventilators. ORMC had 18 with 13 in ICU and 7 on ventilators. COVID news reminder. On Monday, President Biden received his COVID-19 booster shot at the White House. Last week, the CDC recommended Pfizer boosters for older adults, long-term care facility residents, some people with underlying health conditions, and adults at increased risk of COVID-19 because of their jobs. About 20 million Americans are eligible for a third shot of the Pfizer vaccine. The urgent care on 42nd Street remains closed. All staff have been relocated to JVS Parkway and West Side. Need a vaccine? The City of Odessa, University of Texas Permian Basin, and the Ector County Health Department will continue a COVID-19 vaccination clinic. The clinic will begin Tuesday and is open Tuesday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the UTPB Soccer Complex parking lot. Drivers are asked to not line up on the Highway 191 frontage road. First and second shots will be offered. Third shots will be available for those who have passed the six-month threshold, unless a doctor's note is provided. Information on booster shots is subject to change in accordance with CDC guidelines. The vaccination clinic is open to the public. 500 vaccines are available each day. No appointment or pre-registration is needed. Both Pfizer and Moderna will be available. Bring a vaccination card. Wait times are expected to increase without vaccination card and your driver's license. Pay It Forward sculpture unveiled. A sculpture with the letters P-I-F, meaning Pay It Forward, was unveiled Monday on the green space outside the Ector County ISD Administration Building. A collaborative project between Complex Community Federal Credit Union and the AVID program and career and technical education students. It is meant to inspire future generations of students. Each panel of the iron sculpture includes an inspiring phrase of hope. It was created by 2020 seniors as part of the senior experience. In his remarks, Superintendent Scott Murray talked about partnerships. Today is really a celebration of partnership, a celebration of one of these opportunities. The object that you see behind me did not happen because of one person, one organization, one club, or one district. It happened because of a variety of different individuals and organizations who came together with a common vision. They shared the common vision amongst each other to create what you see behind me and to deliver a powerful message, Murray said. As you listen to our speakers this afternoon and you look at this piece of art behind me, think about the collective greatness that it took to make this happen today, because we did not do this alone. It was done with a variety of organizations and individuals coming together to make sure good things happen for our children, Murray added. Jason Burridge, President and CEO of Complex Community Federal Credit Union, said the credit union has partnered with ECISD for more than 13 years to develop young people who are financially capable. The artwork includes lessons like budgeting, credit, interviewing, entrepreneurship, and 5 years ago, the credit union came up with the idea to develop a special program for the AVID seniors. We call it the senior experience. Each year we work to develop a theme. Each year is a different theme for the different groups. And the students take on a path of discovery. Now, the pandemic definitely did present challenges to the presentation, but the students were up to the challenge. They went on a journey with us to challenge them to discover what they could do to live their lives and how they can pay it forward, Burridge said. Paying it forward is vital. It's a vital concept for our kids to learn and understand. They learn that every single thing they do matters, not only for today, but for generations to come. They also learn that being intentional changes the world around them, he added. Each child represents one or more student and their commitment to make a change in the world. This year was especially exciting because we widened our net to include more from ECISD. Not only did the AVID seniors participate, but we also had the CTE team. They designed it from the beginning to the final execution. And the CTE team also helped bring our vision to life right here, Burridge added. Amy Anderson, District Director of the AVID program, said the senior experiences impact students' lives far beyond the present moment. As we begin to design this current experience that you see behind us, the beautiful product of the class of 2021, excitement grew because we were aligning our work and our efforts through AVID, CTE, Complex, Community, and beyond that, Anderson said. Lead welding instructor Nate Armendariz presented plaques to Fernando Gonzalez, Carlos Moreno, both seniors at Odessa High School, and Complex Community FCU and Standard Structures, Inc. Company representatives could not attend. Esmeralda Carrion Lanez, a 2021 Permian High School graduate who is now in culinary arts at Odessa College, said this was the first time she had seen the sculpture. Carrion Lanez said it shows how much hard work went into the project. She added that the pandemic year changed her. It made me realize that I'm on my own time. I can't really waste any of it. You never know when life is going to be cut. You just always have to take advantage of it, Carrion Lanez said. Moreno and Gonzalez said they were gratified by the final product. I think it came out amazing, Gonzalez said. Mary said the sculpture is the voice of our children. He added that although last year was difficult because of COVID, the students had their mind on doing for others. This is from the class of 2021, and those kids are gone. They've graduated, whether they're living in our community or other places, but their voice will continue for years and years to come. Perhaps someday their children could come and see this, or even other students that are part of the system. Community members can come by and understand the voice of the class of 2021. What was on their mind? What were they thinking and feeling? So I'm excited about it. And then to the pay it forward concept, that's what this is all about, Mary said. Permian honors National Merit AP Scholars. 12 National Hispanic and African American Scholars plus AP Scholars were recognized during a small ceremony Monday in the foyer at Permian High School. Advanced Placement Scholars were added because many of the Permian students received both. The National Hispanic Scholars are Allison Blount, Angel Luna, J.C. Unglin, Joaquin Armendariz, Jonathan Martinez, Madeline Ramirez, Noe Rodriguez, and Nadia Brito. The National African American Scholar is Sarah Abera. AP Scholars are Joaquin Armendariz, Kyler Fife, Swetha Kesavan, Angel Luna, with distinction, Jonathan Martinez, Drew Kumar Patel, and Madeline Ramirez. Fife could not attend Money's events. In August, the College Board awarded 32,000 students from across the country with academic honors from the College Board National Recognition Programs for excelling in the classroom and on College Board assessments. More than 80,000 students from all 50 states were eligible to join the College Board National Recognition Programs, which grant students with academic honors that can be included on college and scholarship applications. Colleges and scholarship programs identify students awarded National African American, Hispanic, Indigenous, and/or Rural Small Town recognition through College Board's Student Search Service. These programs help students from the underrepresented backgrounds stand out during the college admissions process, Permian Principal Delisa Stile said. This will be a great thing for you to put on your resumes, your college applications, as you prepare for the next chapter. Stile said the students were eligible because they have a GPA of 3.5 or higher, and they have excelled at the PSAT and the NMSQT, or the PSAT 10. A lot have earned a 3 or higher on 2 or more AP exams, Stile said. Kesavan, Armendariz, and Luna, all 17-year-old seniors, are all glad for the recognition. It's an honor getting recognized by the College Board. It shows that our hard work is being noticed, Luna said. I think it's another thing to add to our college applications, another award. It's a big deal, Luna added. Kessa Van said she has already started on her college applications. Being an AP scholar has helped colleges notice me for more than just what I do in class, so it's also how well I've done on the test as well, Kessa Van added. Armin Darris agreed that it feels good to be recognized for their hard work, all of the tests that we have to sit through, and it feels good to be recognized. Kessa Van said she has been looking into medical programs because she wants to become a doctor. She added that she is looking out of state and in state, but I want to go into the science field, so most of the AP courses I've been taking are science, Kessa Van said. Armandiris said he would like to stay in Texas, but go to the Tier 1 research facilities to also prepare for the medical field. I'm interested in pediatrics, he said. Luna would also like to stay in state, and he is interested in pursuing engineering, so he would like to go to Texas A&M, for example. Specifically, I'm more interested in biomedical engineering, Luna added. Stiles said it's an honor for Permian to be represented on such a diverse level of talent. Of course, we're super proud of our very own kiddos scoring well to be acknowledged. Stiles added, college and career advisor Jennifer Perkins said this is the largest group of honorees PHS has had. Perkins said it puts the students in the running for more scholarship opportunities. It's an acknowledgement of their transcripts and their resumes. They typically get a significant amount of scholarships out of this, out of being a merit scholar, so it's exciting for them, and they have to put in the work too. It wasn't just given to them as well, which is nice, Perkins added. GoFundMe page started for hospital officer. A GoFundMe page has started for the Ector County Hospital District Police Department officer who was killed in a fatal collision in San Antonio. The page was started by Gloria Garza to benefit the family of Sergeant Daniel Valenzuela Jr., who died in a two-vehicle collision on Sunday morning, along with his father and grandmother. As of Monday afternoon, the page had $280 of its $10,000 goal. The page details the funds will help with the expense for funeral services and help relieve some burden that will come in the days, weeks, and months. Valenzuela leaves behind his wife and four children. Valenzuela served in law enforcement for nearly 13 years. He started his career in La Mesa before moving to the Crane County Sheriff's Office and then the Ector County Hospital District Police Department, where he spent the last 7 years. According to KSAT, 17-year-old Elijah James Montalvo was arrested in connection to the fatal collision. Montalvo reportedly ran a red light and collided with Valenzuela's vehicle. Montalvo is being held at the Bejar County Detention Center, where he has three counts of intoxication, manslaughter,